Hello and welcome to In Her Corner, a podcast dedicated to celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport on and off the field.
I'm your host, Liseli Satali.
And today I'm joined by a really great guest, a woman who I've been trying to speak to for a couple of weeks now. But because both of our schedules have been crazy, we haven't managed it. But I'm so glad that we finally got the time. It's the absolutely wonderful Mia Ostergaard. Hey, Mia, how are you doing?
Hello. Nice to be a part of this podcast.
Oh, thank you for making the time. So for everyone listening, Mia is a diversity, equity and inclusion consultant who specializes across three really interesting areas. Sport, which is, of course, close to my heart, which is how we connected. And then, of course, medicine, as well as also looking at leadership development in the area of equity, diversity and inclusion. So I thought today would be really great to talk with you about your journey that has brought you this far. And then to also talk about how it is that we meet this challenge, because you've been working in this space for a while, also across three particular groups that are all different, let's say, journeys of realizing what it means to truly create equitable, inclusive spaces. So I thought it'd be cool to deep dive into that. But before we get into it, I wanted to start off by talking with how you started your career, particularly with the sports angle, right? Because your early years were working for famous former football players like Rio Ferdinand and Jason Robertson, helping establish their charitable foundations to now moving on into more of the professional sectors where you're looking at leadership. How did you begin on that journey?
It's such a big question, because I've had quite a long journey, I would say. So I've always been into sport, always played sport, always knew I wanted to work in sport. I just didn't know what. And I went traveling back in 2010. I was on my second trip around the world, and I was volunteering, and I met an English guy in Costa Rica. And we got talking, and he told me, oh, I studied. I just finished my university degree. I was like, what did you study? And he was like, oh, I did sports journalism, and that's it. I was like, what? You can study that? You can't do that in Denmark, where I'm from originally. So I went online and wrote an application to universities in England. My English wasn't great, so I got him to help me write an application, as you do. And I got accepted. And I actually remember I called my dad from Costa Rica on old-fashioned Skype. You know, you had to go into...
cafe.
12 years ago, Go into like a net cafe. I was like, Dad, I applied to go to university, and my dad was so thankful. He was like, you had four gap years. I'm just happy. I don't care where in the world you're going. Just as long as you get a good degree.
Him.
So that's how I studied sports journalism, and I ended up moving to England, where I'd never been to England before. I moved here to go to university, which is a bit wild at the time. None of my family ever lived abroad. So it was a chance I took to do it. And the course wasn't what I expected it to be, without being too negative, I can say that, I think. And I think I developed quite a lot during that 3 years. I realized I wasn't going to be a reporter that's going to be in the mix zone asking questions. It just wasn't for me. What I found really interesting was the policy side of things. So whenever we did something around UK sport or Sport England around funding or all the policies behind sport, I actually found that really interesting. And then I moved to London. I was like, I spent 3 years just getting slightly good at English at this point. I spent a lot of money doing this, where universities in Denmark are free. So I moved to London without a job or a flat or anything. Lived with a mate from university's parents down in London until I found a job. And I was really lucky. I got an internship at the Rio Ferdinand Foundation. So working for, at the time, one of the world's best defenders, if not the best at the time.
It was, that was the golden age of Manchester United and his career, 100%,
Exactly. And it was just a great opportunity to get into sport, being quite into football, but also I had my charity side, having worked and traveled so much in South America and Central America, where I did a lot of volunteering work in orphanage and football programs for underprivileged kids. And it kind of grew my interest of EDI and sport, because I learned what sport can do for people.
Yes.
Take the professional side that I got, obviously watching Rio, go to Old Trafford and see that side of it and what it brought in terms of wealth and
famous. Yeah, access, privilege, a huge amount,
100%. But it also gave me the side of what it could do to inspire young people. So Rio Ferdinand Foundation works with young people in London and in Manchester. And it developed my insight into, first of all, sport for development, as you use it as a tool. But at the time, it was also about equality and diversity and inclusion for young people, like how we use that in a broader term without calling it EDI. But just what does it actually mean to be young and black in London, for example, comparing to if you grew up in Manchester, we worked with a lot of young girls who got pregnant fairly early on. It was just, it kind of opened my eyes in a new way to different areas. So that's actually how my career started in sport, although I've always been sport interested, always played myself, but that's how it kind of turned the corner from only being about sport, but into EDI as well.
What I want to kind of go back a little bit to there was talking about how obviously your interest in even applying to the foundation was probably fueled by this gap year that you'd had where you'd seen firsthand what sort of development or intervention programs could do through sport. Was there anything in particular that you, from that experience you learned, and now when you look back to seeing how people are framing and looking at equity, diversity, and inclusion, that you think we've missed, that was a success factor for those charity programs that maybe we're not translating so well, and how we're thinking about equity, diversity, and inclusion now in the context of sport?
I think when I think back about that work in particular, because that's with young people, the foundations very much still exist and still do amazing work with young people. I think there's something about being taught quite early on about different culture, about accepting people. And I do think there's a change in generations right now where young people are much more aware, much more open and accepted than we used to be. I think there is a slight generation change with that. When I worked at the Rio Ferdinand Foundation, I moved into the Jason Roberts Foundation, which also worked with young people in London. And I was a part of developing a curriculum that we did at the foundation that was delivered for young people. And it was called EDI for young people. Mm-hmm. So they actually developed a curriculum to teach young people what it meant. And I remember one trip we did, we took young people from Northern Ireland to London and just seeing the different cultures, if you could imagine, a group of, I think they were 14, 15 year old, taking a group of Northern Ireland boys into London and just seeing how they were on a course together. And it was asking questions around EDI, like, what do you understand about this culture? Or what do you understand about this scenario? What do you feel about that? And seeing that from young people in such a young age where the light bulb goes boom, and I just thought we're missing a trick as a community overall, right? We could teach our young people, our children, right from the beginning about acceptance of everything.
Agreed. And I want to just unpick a little bit for you. Do you think that by not being more deliberate about teaching this in curriculum as early as possible, that it actually makes the work that you then have to do now professionally much more difficult and inaccessible to make the impact we're looking for?
Yeah, I do think that, because if you come into a workplace and you have 250 individuals or staff, you come in from an EDI point of view and have to develop ideas and new policies and try and change things or add new values into your organizations. Mm-hmm. But if you pick out these 250 individuals and each of them have taught from the beginning about inclusion and their own privilege, it's a lot to do about your own privilege and understanding, which is something I learned when I did this work very early on, my privilege of being white and being Danish. It kind of opened my eyes massively. So I think now when I go into organizations, it's kind of, you have to look at the wider picture, but you also have to understand that these are individual humans who all come from different backgrounds, which means all of them will have different thoughts and ideas about their own privilege and what it means. And when we say words like anti-racism or anti-homophobia, what does that mean to individuals and not just on a company level? This is what we say as a company.
Yeah, no, definitely agreed. And I think that particular work there that you're talking about from an early age, you being very cognizant about your privilege as a white Danish woman, is such an interesting one, because I think a lot of people, at least I was taught a lot about racism, because obviously being black, growing up particularly in South Africa and then moving to Scotland, I was taught a lot about racism and being very aware of my difference and that of my sister's differences, in a, particularly in a white culture. But never did I sort of think, if people, particularly white people, because I was adopted by a white family, as I know that they were never really given the, let's say, access or tools to unpack the fact that they had privilege because of their skin color and their nationality. So for you, what was that moment that gave you that awareness? Because obviously, you know, the way Scandinavian countries are socialized and kind of mediated in the world is that you have this really great egalitarian society that is very socialist first and very matriarchal. But how do you then, in that context, still manage to find a way to see, actually, I still have an advantage here that I'm not necessarily, when I leave this bubble of Denmark, I'm very much, let's say, on a higher social order just because of how society has developed. How did you get into the skin of that?
Well, I think I'm still learning. And I think the older I get and the more I see, the more I realize about my own privilege, but also about what Denmark actually think about themselves. And I don't mean that as a specific positive thing. So I first kind of realized my own privilege when I was 19 and I traveled for the first time. For anyone who knew me when I was younger, I didn't used to be a very nice person, if I had to say so. Like I just look at that person because I didn't. I was spoiled in many ways, and I didn't realize I was reacting. Things happened when I was younger. My mom left, so I grew up mostly with my dad and my two brothers, and I had been reacting in a negative way towards others as well.
That's tough.
And I think when I went away, that's when, for me, I started to become the person I am today. And it didn't happen overnight, but it did happen on that trip where I started to realize what was going on in the big world. So the last 15 years, I think almost every month I build on that, where I learn more and more about myself and my own privilege, but also what the position of a country like Denmark, one of the world's richest country, have in this world that we're living in. And the more I've been away, the less Danish I think my family and friends probably see me, because I'm so aware of our position of a rich country. And we also had slavery in Denmark, and no one ever talks about it. We know we talk a lot about it in the UK and the history with that, but no one in Denmark, we don't talk about it, and we are afraid to admit why are we such a rich country?
I was going to say, has no one ever had the conversation about where all the wealth came from? Did it just sort of magically appear?
We have funny stories. I remember at school, we talked about it. Like, we talked about being the Vikings, right? We went to England and robbed and steal and raped. Yeah. And it was like a funny story.
Yeah.
And only now have the narrative changed a little bit to being a bit more serious. It's kind of hard, actually, becoming a person who's so aware of my own privilege, becoming such an activist, so to say. I'm a massive feminist. I am celebrating Pride right now, and I would call myself an anti-racist, and I'm trying to always get people with me. Yeah. But then coming back to Denmark and talking to friends and family here who haven't experienced it, who doesn't care, who
they
grew up
had
in
exposure.
The countryside, bought a house in the country, never seen it, never had to face it, never had to talk about it. And that scares me so much, just because I left at some point and obviously stayed away for many years, I had realized and I wanted to be better. I wanted to do better. And then seeing people that you love, and I still love them, not being able to care. Yeah, but I guess it's the same with everything, right? You must have friends and family where we talk 100%. About single-use plastic. Some people just don't care.
And no, it's hard. And many other topics as well. You know, I often point to a lot in Black communities that has it's been interesting to see a lot of the conversations around race equity come to light. And one of the ones that I think a lot of Black communities shy away from, and you probably have had exposure to given the communities that you've worked in across the UK as well, the US, but it's colorism, right? Colorism is one of those tone deaf areas that's not spoken about, but the fact that it exists within Black communities and there's more of a value placed on lighter skinned Black people within Black communities themselves, and a disadvantage, let's say, that's socialized around having darker skin, that enables racism itself. And that's something that I think, you know, Black communities, and I've certainly struggled with a lot of things around hair and how you style your hair, whether you have more silky kind of European texture hair or whether you have more Afro hair and the connotations of all of that. Those are all things that are upheld within Black communities. And I think the confrontation, and I find to, you know, sort of relates to the difficulty you're having there with your own sort of sphere and circle going back home, the difficulties I have with my family back home and also over here in the UK is that trying to talk about those things within Black communities, you kind of reach an impasse because it's sadly having to think about how taking ownership of the harm that we do to ourselves, right? I'm not saying we're to blame solely, and that is not where I'm coming from, but it's to understand that within any power privilege structure, there is an enabling and condoning structures, and how do you confront them and your part in that? And I think that's something I've struggled with, something I'm still working through. And so I can totally relate. But I think my frustrations, I think, to share, and yours, is that there are people within our lives and our circles that's such a difficult conversation to access because there's never been that opportunity for them to step out of that sphere, go and live somewhere else, go and experience different people, different culture tracks to then understand that. And I think that's something that I'm definitely seeing, thinking about how the sport world is confronting the topic of equity, diversity, and inclusion. You know, a lot of it, particularly in the broadcast space, which I want to spend some time talking about because we both shared experience both working in that capacity. But it's that, you know, oh, let's just put more brown and black faces on TV. Let's put more women on there. Let's, you know, pick promos that we start cutting to talk about online abuse, that we talk about LGBTQIA rights. And we just kind of do this, let's call it Olympic cycles of, you know, activism, but in a very short segment in programming. But how do you actually get under the skin of restructuring those organizations, thinking about who's at the top of them, who buys the content, who commissions it, who then recruits them? What kind of accountability is there in that organization when they make those wonderful statements we saw about a year ago, from when we're speaking now in June? How do you build that system in there to truly make those people care rather than be ticking boxes, right? And I wanted to talk to you about that. How do you get that mindset shifted in the sporting culture?
Well, I think it's happening automatically right now, in a way, because we used to have a workforce, let's say the UK would have a workforce of 85% white straight male. That used to be the whole of the workforce. It was like that not even 40 years ago, right? Yeah. And it's shifted a little bit in terms of more women coming into the workplace. And now we're seeing more Black and Asian and ethnic minority people coming in as well. So when we look at the demographic of the younger people in organizations, especially the bigger organizations, and especially if you look in the bigger cities as well, it's still obviously an issue. So if you go out on the countryside, I think that's completely different issues. It can't be, you can't have one fixed, this is how you should do it. These are the
everywhere.
These are the things you should do to change it for both in cities and on the countryside. For me, that's two different things. So if we talk about in the city, I think there's an automatic change right now because we see the younger generation coming up. First of all, there's much more tolerance. There's much more acceptance. There's much more coolness around anti-racism, feminism, speaking up, being who you are. I think organizations are being better at trying to do more in that way. That you can't avoid that young people are coming into organization and screening from bottom up, that they won't change. I do think there is still a massive, massive problem when you look at the leadership. Most organizations have one or two tokenism, either women or people of color, that sits in there. That, as you're saying, we just handpick you because you fit into our diversity. Yeah, right now. So I do think in leadership positions that it's still a massive problem. And I do still think that it's not going to go away for the next 10 years, unfortunately. I still think it's going to take a long time if we don't have the right people in organization asking for these changes. But I think it's a great thing right now. I have never seen so many EDI roles on LinkedIn, just to mention something. I'm not saying that people like myself who does this job can come into organization and change everything at all, but I am seeing that more and more organizations are willing to actually spend money on people, and that's one of the things that I remember we talked about 10 years ago when I started out working around this, is that you need to have people doing this work. It can't just sit with HR that they can spend 2 hours every month doing. No, you need to have a person, if not a whole team, who sits with this to really deliver changes. And I think more and more companies are doing that. You still hear about the company that hired one person that they don't want to make any changes. But most of what I see, there is actually changes to be made, and more. When we also talk about mental health, obviously, with the Royal College of Psychiatrists, when we talk about mental health, this comes into play as well, because we talk about being ourself at work. Right. So if you cannot be yourself at work, whether it's because you're gay or you are non-binary or you are black or whatever your protective characteristic is, if you cannot be yourself at your job, you cannot deliver the best you can do, which all the research shows. There is money that is financed behind having diversified workforces, and the more we work towards that, which I think companies do, most companies do, they work towards diversifying their workforce more and more. One thing is they're being told they should, but another thing is they can actually see the results from that. But as we're seeing that, we're also creating more opportunities for staff to come together saying, hey, we're seeing this, and we're not just one person in this group anymore. We are a whole group that sits in different departments that will talk to our managers, will talk to our leaders to have changes made. And I think that's where we're really seeing the difference now, is that it's coming from bottom up. And
exactly,
I think
it's the groundswell, right? You're talking about the groundswell. 100%. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. And companies want to do it now. They're seeing it as a good thing. I actually think that most organization who's a little bit frontful, or I don't know, forward thinking, will be proud of going into a boardroom or leadership team meetings and seeing diversity. I think quite a lot of people now find it embarrassing if they don't. And they actually go to their marketing team, hey, we got 6 white guys on our front row in our banner when you step on our website. That's things that people are starting to noticing now. And again, not all companies, I know that,
There's still, but the fact that it's a point of conversation.
That more all of the companies that I go into anyway, it's across all teams that's now being told, where before maybe one or two persons like in HR, hey, you need to think about when you're hiring to have more diversity. But now it's actually, hey, marketing team, hey, comms team, you have to think about it all the time.
Yes.
And that's when we see the changes happening.
Definitely. And it's about, I guess, what you're talking about there. It's about making it a part of the business operation and the DNA, not putting it, as you say, a little ad hoc operation stuck onto HR because they deal with people, but actually making everyone say, what does it mean for this organization to be truly representative of the kind of talent and population of people we want to appeal to, but also want to benefit from coming into our space and feeling a sense of belonging because they don't feel a part, because we have put so many barriers of saying only this type of leadership, only this type of person, only this type of is the way in, right? And I think that's why sport.
Exactly.
And yeah. And I think for me, which is what I wanted to ask you about, is to say, what is the sort of biggest learning you've had? Because obviously you go at work, you work with Midtjylland. I'm hoping I'm saying the name of the football team correctly in Denmark. Midtjylland, you also work with the Royal College of Psychiatrists, like you say there. And obviously you also work with Versify, which is really the leadership aspect of developing leaders and organizations to really look at how they become more meaningfully engaged with that groundswell we're talking about. So have there been particular learnings from that you have observed that we can start as an industry to think about doing more intently?
I would say it's quite interesting because those three roles that I do right now, they're so different and they come from three different perspectives. Mm. One is a football club in Denmark, which is, you can't compare it to where the UK is. I would say where Denmark is where UK was 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So a lot of my learnings and my tools and my experience that I have from the UK, I can't use some of it because they're so far behind that we are still where we're.
You're day one, right? Yeah.
Where people still use the N-word, for example. Like that's how backwards it is. And it's also on the countryside over here, which it's again, countryside and cities are completely different. But and in terms of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, because I'm there as a staff member. My job there is very different as well to when I do consultancy work around leadership and EDI, where I go in, I analyze the company, I write my recommendations, and I go out again. Sometimes I'm brought back in again saying, okay, can you help us deliver some of these recommendations?
Yeah.
Where at RC Psych, it's more, I'm a part of the team. I sit on different projects to ensure that we have EDI in our minds all the time that we ensure. So right now they're looking at rebuilding their six floors office space. And I'm brought into that project team together with finance, together with HR, to ensure that EDI, our thought, is accessibility better now. It has to be. How do we increase it? So I sit with a consultancy that rebuilding this. So that's just an example of how it comes from different angles, depending on how you are. If you're full-time staff, if you're a consultant, or how much you know where you are right now. Like, are we in London?
Understood.
Are we on the countryside? Are we in the UK?
Yeah.
You must know the same from the US, right? So
you
can't have that fixed.
One size fits all.
Like
No, there's not. No. And I guess what the key sort of learning there that I'm hearing from the different experiences and the different sort of hats you're wearing, but still with the same strategic thought and purpose of work, is being able to meet people in the moment of their learning, right? And being making sure that you are tailoring the program of work to get them to where we want, which is that everyone is as conscious and as deliberate and as intentful, but trying to make sure what are the key things that you can do structurally within that organization. So that example that you talked about, actually being on the teams that decide how a building is pulled together to make sure it takes into account everyone's needs, all the way through to thinking about coaching of the development team at senior level to say, actually, are they missing within their learning when they're thinking about employee development? Are they missing not understanding what the barriers for developing women who come from inner city schools from low income backgrounds are to get them to come up to C-suite? Are they thinking about, hey, our board at the moment primarily indexes white Oxbridge males. How are we going to get more kids who came from college, didn't go to university, but have done a fantastic job of working their way up to be really great middle managers in their company now? But how do we pull them up to C-suite? Because they don't currently see that pathway for themselves. I think it's all of those kind of engines, right? That makes your job incredibly tough, by the way. I'm summarizing it here as if it's the easiest thing in the world, but that makes it incredibly, incredibly tough. And another thing I wanted to talk to you about was, obviously you talked there that you work in different geographies across diversity, equity, inclusion, but How did you find the experience first when you came to the UK? Obviously, you said you had that language barrier, you had the cultural barrier, and then you had the navigating university, and then you got into the professional setup. How did you first find people react to you, particularly when you went into organizations? Because you used to work at Sky, for example, before working on diversity, equity, inclusion there. How did you find people reacted to you as a white woman working in a space that, again, has been socialized as one where predominantly people who are of color work? How did you find that experience?
Well, as I said, I think it's developing in terms of there's more and more roles. So I think 5 years ago, probably, you would see a lot less people doing that, if you would find many. But I have found that people look at me like, oh, you're the race and equality manager, but you're white. What would you know about this? And then adding a layer of being foreign. Right.
Yes.
So
yes.
I feel it. I see it. I've heard things as well. But I think I learned to ignore it. I'm quite good as a person to ignore other people's judgment of me. I think where my biggest judgment comes from myself.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people like that. But if I can live up to my own expectations, my expectations of myself are fairly high. That's what mattered the most. And I think it comes with age a little bit. You probably find this as well.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like that a few years ago. It comes with age, becoming a little bit older, and you learn to shut out all of the noise.
Yes.
So I think over time, I know that, first of all, I worked in football. I was a female working in football. The sexism that I experienced back then kind of gave me... first of all, encouraged me. It gave me anger, but it also gave me a thick skin to be like, okay, well, I'm here to do my job as well as everyone else. So I can't be bothered with other people, whether you think I shouldn't be here because I'm a female or because I'm white. Let me deliver and show you what I can do instead.
Yeah.
And then you can judge me. But it's hard for me if I then get judged on work that I don't deliver well enough, or people question that. That's when it becomes tough. But I do think that delivering to your own standards and your own expectations is far more important than delivering to anyone else's.
Yeah.
When we talk about our mental health, and especially the last year, right?
It's
our own expectations are the highest. So if we can live up to them, screw everyone else.
Yeah, no, and that's such a valuable learning, you know. It's such a valuable learning, but a very difficult learning. And I think particularly a very difficult one, as you say, when you are dealing with people's prejudices, right? And how do you learn to shut that out from then defining you and your own perception of your value and your abilities? So just to ask you, how do you think you develop that skill set? Because I think that's something particularly as, and I mean, I don't mean to generalize, and you can correct me here because you have much more, let's say, data to back this up, but I would say generally from my experiences, women find this a lot harder, a mindset to develop, particularly in the workplace when you're going in as one of the few occupying a seat, particularly at leadership level, right? That's something I struggled with. How did you develop that skill set and that resilience? Because what you're talking about there is a mental resilience to be really rooted about what you value, how you meet that standard, and just protecting yourself to just stay really rooted to that. How did you develop that skill set?
I think through failures. I think every time you fall, you build something up. There's something about the failures that you learn more from your failures than you learn from your successes, right?
Yeah.
100%. And I do think I have failed a lot in my life and in my career as well. And I made mistakes. I made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
But for each of them, I like to think that I learned something from it.
Yeah.
And I definitely think as humans, that's, and some people don't.
Yes.
It's not for everyone.
It's not for everyone
to fail like I have failed, but it is for some people. And I think you and I are similar in that way, that there are some people who are much more straightforward. There's not that many ups and downs and bumps and highs.
It's a line. It's just one flat line.
It's just a flat line of living. And they're happy, but they don't ever get that far down. They never get that high up. And I think some people, me included, are people who can go extremely high. I have been so high. We haven't talked about it yet, but when I worked at Sky Sports and I delivered,
Let's talk about that now. Because, yeah, because I did want to talk about that, because just there, you know, I don't want you to fall into the trap of everyone believing here that Mia is not successful. She's incredibly successful and talented. So I do want to talk about those successes that you had, particularly early on in the journey of going into a big organization like that, that has such a huge cultural influence here in the UK, and helping it to start to get its head around the fact that it had a lack of inclusiveness, didn't have great equitable practices, and certainly not as much diversity as we now see in Sky. And they're able to, you know, really sort of last year, from the last 18 months, I would say, able to start showing that in their programming, start showing that in the investments that they're making. So I would be great to talk about that and what you learned from that experience, because that's probably one of those experiences that solidified your ability to keep shut out the noise of the doubters, right?
100%. That's probably been the biggest learning from my time at Sky. And I was just there for over a year, I think. But I think the example of when I was at Sky, there was a former boss there called Andy Kane. So Andy is really the example of how one very senior leader can make changes. So he decided he wanted to make a change. He started to hire Black presenters, Asian presenters. He started to diversify his newsroom a little bit. So Sky Sports News is a piece of Sky Sports. Sky Yes. Sports falls in Sky, and so on. And he made changes into his own newsroom at a time. And he also hired me in. And that was at the same time that Raheem Sterling was racially abused at Stamford Bridge, that rememberable
yes.
accident.
Yeah, when he went, Bridge. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and Andy wanted to do something new. So he came to me, he knew that I worked for a lot of diversity organization. I used to work for Women in Football, Football Blacklist, Becomes. I worked with Leon Mann. And he knew that I had contacts as well, because I worked with a lot of footballers as well. So he came to me and he said, Mia, what can we do differently? Can you create something? Can you come up with an idea or plan where we don't just talk about racist incidents after each of them and then we forget it the next day?
It's just so a hot news topic. It was treated exactly, just as a news segment, and then you moved on.
Yeah, exactly. So I created the idea of tackling racism. I've wrote about all the different aspects of racism, because what we see on Sky Sports, especially, or Sky Sports News, is the racist incidents that happened at Premier League or Championship or international football.
Yeah.
You don't see all the racism that exists at grassroots level or in the women's game, because it's still not that spoken about.
No.
So I came up with a plan of doing TV series about racism in football that wasn't just Premier League, but it was about fan behavior, it was about anti-Semitism, about Asians in football, about women, and created the series at that time. But at that time, as you just asked me about doubters, right? So I sat in a room with people who looked at me like, who the hell are you? You literally came from the street, came in and got to deliver your own program. I came up with the idea and you're white. I get it. I completely get it. Mm. So I had to prove why I was there, what I could deliver.
Yeah.
Because people looked at me like, what is she doing here? And I think it taught me a lot. That I remember exactly that moment it happened. I sat in a big room full of people, and they all stared at me really angrily, like, what are you doing here? Yeah. And all I can say is, I got it. Like, I really did get it. I could understand that, because I would feel the same if I worked in an organization where there was very few females and they would do a program about women or sexism or discrimination towards women, and they brought a man in from the street, right?
Yes,
I would feel the same. So I kind of got that. And it's sometimes about turning the tables a little bit to try and understand people's perspective and people's understanding, but also there is so much feelings involved with this.
Yes.
When you have
deeply emotive, it's deeply emotive. Yeah.
Exactly. Whether you suffered sexism or racism or homophobia or any form of discrimination, you understand if other people have. And I'm not comparing, I know it's completely different. Mm-hmm. And also, when obviously being a Black female, you can suffer from both forms of discrimination at one sentence or like every day in your life. But it's sometimes taking a step back and seeing it from other people's perspective. And I do think that also comes with age a little bit and learning and being in situations that's not always comfortable and hearing people say things that's not always comfortable, but then being like, you know what, I understand it. That's okay. Let me show you that I can help do something good. And I did, and I do think that all the doubters that sat in that room no longer feel like that. One of them is one of my best friends now. So, you know, it's sometimes I could have easily walked out of that room thinking, I am never going to work these people who hate me just for being white. And I don't think that's what that was the case. Yeah. But I could have had that
feeling. It could be the immediate defensiveness, right? Because we are human beings, and sometimes the natural reaction is to be defensive when you feel a form of unfair criticism, right? Rather than, as you say, taking the time to understand what's motivating that voice and that point of view, to then be able to work with that person to show that actually you're there for the same purpose and there for the same goal. And just on that topic, with obviously that series with Sky, as you talked about it, bringing that wider lens, because I think often people, as you say, when you point out incidents that have kind of, let's say, been given that high press coverage and that awareness, people often think about it as just the form of discrimination that lays within sport, just being at that one level of layer, that professional elite spectrum, because that's what, let's say, sells the newspapers, sells the video click throughs. But thinking about the other structural things, as you talked about their fan behavior, grassroots programs, etc. Did you feel that obviously there's quite a bit of attention, right, when you're a broadcaster in that sense? Those are the clients that you're essentially now starting to make programming that you're criticizing the structures they've built by showing a lens on them, right? Not directly saying they're wrong, but showing a lens on them, making the public aware of it. How did you manage that tension of being able to bring those partners along? Because at the moment, a lot of people working in your space, but also in spaces that are parallel to that, for all the good reasons that you stated earlier about studying organizations, started to take this work more seriously and embedding it in their operations. What kind of learnings did you get from that you could pass back about how you bring people along on that difficult journey of starting to confront those shortcomings?
What we did with Sky was, when we started the programs, we also did a meeting before them where we talked about it. We talked about, for staff, why are we doing this? What's the point of it? What language do we use? Why don't we use this language? So it was also an internal staff learning curve, which I guess skills some of the social media team, for example, who, if you ever go on Sky Sports social media, there's a lot of abuse. Whenever they talk about racism, taking the knee, etc., there's so much abuse on social media on their accounts as well.
Yeah.
And that's staff as well.
Yes.
And some of these staff are people of color as well, who will feel it. In their workplace, then it's not directed towards them as people, but it's directed towards Black people or Asian people who could be themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So we took that at Sky Sport as a learning curve for staff as well, how to handle these things. And it happened. As you talked about, we did a program about fan behavior, and it was extreme what we found and what we saw, and some of the footage that was storage that we had to show to indicate how bad it is.
Yeah.
I am a little bit worried that some people you cannot change. Mm. And I'm only starting to realize that now. I have for many years believed that I could turn, not that I personally could, but both
the right level of education and socialization, you could help to change someone and help them become better aware and responsible of their position in the world, right?
Yeah. And I'm not saying you can't move people at all, but I think some people are really difficult in terms of their upbringing. Mm. And if you reach a certain age, and not because it's age specific, but I do think there is a group of people in this world that will be very, very hard to teach and educate and to make understand. And I think it comes down to people's privilege, people, emotional intelligence, a lot of these things that goes on in our head that is hard to switch on or switch off. And they have taken what they always learned. If they have always been told that white people are better than black people and they're white and they believe this, and they've gone to a certain age where they no longer want to learn, and there is people who doesn't want to do that. It's hard to change that.
And how do you deal with that when you come across somebody like that in your in your line of work? How have you dealt with the challenge of that?
I don't think I actually come across anyone in my work where I thought, wow, I can't work with you. I think because it's a workplace, people tend to maybe hide their feelings.
I was
going to
say a facade. The facade.
Exactly. Where I think where I have struggled the most with people like that is my personal life. If I speak to friends or family, where I get really personal, offended that people can't understand it or don't want to be a part of it, or especially friendship that you have had for a long time, or family that you can't get rid of, who, from my point of view, are as I spoke about a little bit earlier, right? The Danish grew up in Denmark, never really seen the world, never understood what racism means. And it's at a level where I'm like, wow, are you that ignorant? And how do you continue to love people and hang out with people if I feel like that about them? And they probably feel the same about me. How can you be like that? Why are you fighting for other people? Why can't you just close your mouth and your brain and your heart and I don't know,
and pretend that you can't see the world, right? That would be a lot easier.
Why do you talk about structural racism? Come on, it doesn't exist. And it's I feel that's worse when it's personal for me. Because working in EDI, it's a constant battle. Like, I have to say, you have to be strong for your mental health.
I was about to ask you about that.
You don't switch off, and you hear and you see thing, and every day I try and fight for people who are in the minority at the workplace.
Yes.
And when I get a no, it's not always personal me that it will hit, right? But it's others that I do it for, why I do this work. It's for the ones in the minority. It's often easier for me to actually work around racism or anti-racism because it's not personally affecting me in a structural way anyway. Where when it comes to sexism, God, it's hard. It's really, really hard for me. And because it hits home. And it's when you hear people say sexist thing in the workplace or fight against creating equal pay, that, God, and you can't let it go. I can't let it go. I am terrible at that. I have a mind that constantly thinks I'm a bad sleeper because I think way too much. And sometimes I think I should not be doing this job because I can't let it go. And people like, well, why do you care so much? If I fight about structural racism, for example, and I can't. It's and I guess in one way I couldn't do this job if I didn't care enough to do this.
I was just about to say, I think we need more people like you doing this work, because you know you need to be outraged for everybody, right? You can't just be like, oh, that's not a group that I belong to, so I'm not going to fight so much. I'm not going to be so bothered. But oh, this one I'm definitely going to take up arms for because it's really close to me. Or people I identify most with. I think it's about, I think one of the biggest sort of learnings that society hasn't socialized enough in us. And I think this is why we're in such an elementary stage, particularly when I look at the pan of the sports industry, to start to understand that advocacy around inequity needs to be for all groups, not just particular silos of groups, because otherwise we don't move forward, because then you're going to leave somebody behind and create new structural inequities, right? So then you just kind of rinse, repeat, but kind of different. And I think that's such a difficult learning. But I think with people like you, I know it gives you sleepless nights, but For me, it gives me comfort to know that people like you work in this space, because I know that if I'm not there screaming loudly about the things that affect me as a Black woman, to know that there actually is a white woman who will do that is a huge step forward. I think some of the things that I've definitely experienced in the workforce, particularly in the sports industry, and you could probably speak to this, particularly when you were working in the foundation sport development space, is that a lot of people, unless there's somebody who's representing that group at that table trying to make that decision, and often they're kept out of those rooms to make those decisions, to have that conversation, we don't move forward, right? And that's the saddest thing.
Yeah, 100% agree. But I also think it's important to remember that just because you are in the minority, so my ex-partner was Black, and when we talked about racism, I could tell he didn't understand really. Of course, he knew what racism was and he suffered it, but he didn't know. He couldn't tell me stats. He couldn't tell me what structural racism was. He could just tell me incident where I could tell him that was racism. He was stopped in Holborn because he was walking there in a suit and the police stopped him. What are you doing here? And we had a lot of discussions about racism. And I guess that we have to remember that just because you're Black or because you're a lesbian or because you're non-binary or transgender or whatever minority you are in our society, it doesn't mean you
the subject
can
matter
work
expert.
In EDI or you should be the person who brings it up every time.
Yes.
Like, you work in marketing.
Yes.
Right? So every time you have a meeting, it shouldn't be you pointing out, do you remember to think about Black voices or Black communities or pictures of Black people? It shouldn't be your job. It should be an EDI person who sits with that, who specialized in identifying options and how we do it and when we do it and when would be the right time to point this message and do remember to celebrate Black History Month, South Asian History Month, Pride with the same amount
level
of events
and resource and resource and intent and also strategy, right? And then I think that's something that in marketing we do need to start learning a lot more around. I think sometimes this also what happens that I don't like seeing in organizations has been, particularly in the last 12 months, has been people being like, oh, well, you know, we'll leave it to the EDI people to tell us what the right way to do that is. I think there needs to be more of a gathering around people who work in equity, diversity, and inclusion in organizations to learn that level of strategic thought to embed how we approach things and the belief in why we should approach things the way we do to create that representation. And as you say, not putting that burden of pressure on the person with the protected characteristic to be the person to have to keep putting their hand up. And as you say there with the example with your ex-partner, having to make them work out how to define inequity that they're feeling in order for them to feel like it's valid, right? Because that's really what the danger is there, that people start to say, oh, because I can't describe it in the academic terms, I can't be it. But then the other side of things is to say, don't expect just because somebody represents the group that we need to advocate for to get better visibility and representation, that therefore they have to be the subject matter expert just by default of their identity. I think that's nuts.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's a part of the culture change, right? In organizations, it's about the values that they add into it, which is becoming more and more popular. Is to look at what is the values, what are we? I recently had a conversation at FC Midtjylland, the football club that I work with, and they talked about, well, outside to our fans, we call ourselves a family football club. But for staff and for the club, actually, what does that mean?
Yes.
What does that mean? What values do you see as being a part of being a family? Because every individual you ask will probably mention different words when we talk about what's the values of a family football club, right?
Yeah.
And it's sometimes being a bit more specific and putting it into words. The RC Psych have been amazing with their values. And one of their is respect. And they talk about inclusion and respecting others. And this is before my time, but I know that they fired 5 people for not following their values of respect.
Wow.
And seeing organizations like that actually taking a stand, saying, listen, this is not good enough. And And I think we are going to see a more collective move like that, because there is leaders in this and they will show other organizations why they're doing it, why it's worth it. And then hopefully my positions will be completely different in 10, 15 years in most companies anyway. There'll still be companies behind this. But I do think we're seeing a shift right now, and we're also seeing more policies and good practice are created for teams. And I do think that's where we should go, as you're talking about in your team in marketing. Okay, well, everyone should know how to look at these things. And I hate using the word, but it is a tick list. Okay, have we thought about that? If we think about an equality assessment impact.
Yes.
Equality impact assessment.
Yeah.
And we think about, okay, we have to look at from a person who's LGBTQ+. Yeah. Or we have to look at from a person who's Asian, or a person who's disabled, person who's in a wheelchair. Like, how do we look at everything we do
with that lens?
For everything. No. And I do think we are, I think, moving that direction, but there's still a long way to go. But I do see a shift in some organizations I'm in.
Yeah, no, it's really great and so encouraging to hear that. And I think leads quite nicely to where I wanted to take you next, which is just to talk about, you know, obviously you've given us really good insights and learnings there along the way as your career has pivoted and taking you to different cultures, spaces and indeed different organizations. But really rooted with that first love of yours, which is sport and trying to create a world where people understand and can live their full selves. I want to ask you, when you look back sort of in 20, 30 years time, what is that one thing you would love to like have as your legacy piece after having done this work and lived in these spaces? What is the thing that you'd love to overhear someone say about you that you've contributed?
I love to create a change. And as cheesy as it might sound, but for me, and also in every role that I've done, it's what I've said from the beginning. I want to make a change. I want to create a positive change for people who are in the minority in the workplace, or on the football pitch, or on the football stand. You know, I just want people to be more welcomed in the world for everyone.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think it just sounds so cheesy when I say it, but
yeah. But it means a lot, right?
I do want that.
Yeah, it means a lot though. And I think one of the things that I've definitely known of you in the short spell we've got to know each other, but I feel hugely grateful for, is just how authentic your level of care and dedication to this work is. And I think for me, that gives me so much heart. And when you talk about that change piece that you want to leave, I think you've already started to see that. And I have to give a shout out to our mutual friend, Pax, who introduced us. I mean, one of the first things she led with was saying was that you really changed her view of the world and how white women related to black women and those friendship groups. And so I think you're already making those changes. And if people go and look at the impact of the projects that you've instilled at these different foundations and big corporations like Sky, and now such a pivotal area in mental health with the Royal College of Psychiatry and this football club in Denmark that is needing to sort of wake up and see how it can become more global in that family value mindset. I think it's awesome. So I just wish you all the very best in everything you do. Keep shining your beautiful, brilliant light. And thank you for occupying spaces that are difficult, but definitely intentional about making positive change.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much to everybody for listening to another episode of In Her Corner. I've been with the absolutely amazing Mia Ostergaard.